I'd like to invite this morning's speakers up to the table here, microphones, please. Who'd like to kick off with a question? Well, I'll go to Andy, just starting off. You were talking about assessment and diagnosis. Is there any data about misdiagnosis or missed diagnosis in pain clinics?
In the literature search I performed for the talk, I didn't find one piece of data about it. The way I actually found information about sort of information for the talk was actually looking at diagnosis rather than misdiagnosis in the end, because there was nothing there. I don't know, maybe there is something out there that I've missed, but it certainly looks like an area for study perhaps, although I don't know how many pain clinics want to know how many diagnoses they've actually missed. Would be another question.
Colin?
Thank you very much. That was the best talk on CRPS I think I've ever heard. That was great. Some of us are still maybe in the dark ages a bit. I just wondered what you think of guanethidine blocks in CRPS.
I'm possibly not the girl to ask, because we tend, being a tertiary referral centre, we tend to see all those where it hasn't worked. And I'm completely aware there may be people out there who've done fantastically on them. I'm very aware that they can do quite a lot of harm. People find them very uncomfortable to participate in. The research really doesn't suggest that they're terribly effective, and I think the general consensus is that it's worth trying in somebody who has a very sympathetically active limb, and it's worth trying once. There's not a point of doing a course of them, because it really doesn't seem to make any difference, and there's certainly no justification at all to do 8 or 9 and see what happens. So again, I think it's assessment, really, that you just make sure that you have got a hot, sweaty limb and try it and see.
Could I possibly ask Cathy again about the psychosocial aspects of CRPS? Because I just wonder if there's people who develop, start off with one limb and then it develops in the opposite side or in a leg when it's been previously in an arm. Are these people particularly a particular group of people psychosocially, I was thinking?
That's a really good question, because we do quite often see people who it would appear that the CRPS problems have gone to another limb, and sometimes that's the adjacent limb, sometimes it's the limb below it, so an arm could go to a leg. We're really careful that we are meticulous in applying the diagnostic criteria again to that secondary limb, because there's unfortunately a huge amount on the internet where people seem to acquire endless symptoms from each other. So we are very meticulous that we say, okay, does it meet the criteria? If it doesn't, then we say, well, it looks as if possibly you're getting some sort of chronic pain problem in this. Continue all the sorts of activities you've done in your other limb. But we wouldn't give them a diagnosis of CRPS unless we felt it absolutely matched it. Regarding your question about the psychosocial, I mean, there's been excellent studies looking at seeing whether you can predict which patients get CRPS just from surgical interventions. But they have very much the same psychosocial profile as anybody with chronic pain. I think, though, we do very definitely come across those where, as in any chronic pain condition, there's a secondary agenda going on. And so our health psychologist is very helpful in helping us try and tease out those other things. And that's partly the trouble with the diagnostic criteria as well, that a huge amount of it is on subjective report. So that tends to, for those who wish to make it up and not use a limb, it's possible to get a diagnosis of CRPS. So we are fairly meticulous with applying our criteria. I don't know, does that help at all?
Yes, thank you.
Steve?
Yeah, just a paper that I read in the BMJ a few years ago. It was very scary, looking at patients who had attended a medically unexplained symptoms clinic, and they had much higher mortality in the longer term. A lot of extra cases of cancer, whether that was because of their prolonged pain or the prolonged psychological problems, or whether it was the underlying diagnosis when they'd attended the clinic was uncertain. But Professor Vlayan, I was wondering if you'd looked at the induction of fear by medical intervention I get so many patients that have been to see a doctor and they've been told that there's problems with their spine, that something's going to happen.
It's a very intriguing question and something which we will look into. What we have done so far is looked at the influence of the attitudes of professionals regarding, for example, back pain, and the influence on that, on their treatment behavior. And then the next step would be to have a look at the impact on patients' behavior of that. Now, so far we have found, and there's a few number of studies, but they all converge to the same kind of direction, is that the attitudes of professionals regarding the management and in this particular back pain really has an impact on their own treatment behavior, which of course is kind of evident. But the few studies that also looked at the impact on the patients are even more intriguing, in the sense that the professionals' attitudes and beliefs about management of back pain seems to be one of the most potent predictors of the fears that the patients have. There's the two French studies that have appeared in the journal Pain, showing that the best predictor of the patient's fear was the fear of their treating a rheumatologist. We have done one study in physical therapists, looking at the association between the attitudes of physical therapists regarding back pain and the outcome of the treatment in the back pain patients, and we found that it was mediated by the behavior of the physical therapist. It's a very complex area, because you have to deal with both the characteristics of your patients, which also may predict outcome. You have the characteristic of the healthcare provider, and then the interaction of both. So it's a very complicated kind of research. It ties very well into the second pathway leading to fear, which I mentioned very briefly, which is the vicarious and the instructional path. And it's very probable, but we will and we need to study this in more detail, that there are subtle behavioral and verbal signs in the interaction between the healthcare providers and patients that signal danger or harm. And it can be very subtle. And we think that it also has to do with ambiguity during the consultation. A very practical thing. It's very difficult to do this research because there's very few healthcare providers that are willing to join our study when they know that they're going to be the subject themselves. Yeah, but it's a very intriguing and probably an under or a neglected area in looking at fears in patients. Yeah.
Candy,
it
just to. Here. Clearly you put forward a very definitive example of this dairy farmer woman who presents with all of the classical symptoms of CRPS. Mm. On the other hand, Professor Vine gave a very good talk about fear avoidance, and we will have a cohort of what we would call generalised widespread pain symptom patients who will come in, develop neck pain, arm pain, back pain. They then have fear or whatever, and that's the psychological model that we're moving with. But a considerable period of them, you leave them, in my opinion, for 3 or 4 years, and they'll start to say, my fingers are tingling now. Now, I've always put that down as it's because of you're not involved in the normal homeostasis of lifting your cup or whatever it is that you're doing. And invariably, there's a small cohort of them that will get some well-meaning doctor who will say, well, actually, you've got carpal tunnel. Mm. They then have their carpal tunnel done. Yeah. They're then called CRPS. Yeah. And what I would say to you is, do you think because I still effectively treat them differently, as you know, this change that they're getting is part of their functional disuse. It's not. On the other hand, we've got this woman with her CRPS who's exhibiting similar sensory motor discrepancies. And do you think there is a link, or what?
I think there absolutely is a link. If you got those same people to just lie on a couch, shut their eyes, and describe to you how they see their bodies, you would get an almost exact description as you do with the CRPS. So if you do that with a fibromyalgia patient, they report that their hands, and it's always bilateral, and they can show you exactly where it stops, that their hands are huge. And they're very aware that they're very clumsy. So they'll miss, when they peg out the washing on the washing line, they'll miss it, they'll drop things. They have very poor limb position sense. Likewise, they'll perceive that their feet are huge. And quite often they've gone up a shoe size, even though they know when they look at them, they're no different. And if you do chronic low back pain, they report that their backs are huge and that section is very large. And with the fibromyalgia patients, when you put them through our incongruent mirror system, you exacerbate their symptoms very, very rapidly, and they have no idea where their limbs are when they're hidden from view. So even just looking at a whiteboard which occludes one limb from them, if they do incongruent movements, or even congruent movements, they rapidly lose that limb and start to report an increase in their fibromyalgia-like symptoms in that hidden limb. And so I would say to you that actually these people very likely do have a distorted motor sensory problem, and that's probably why they're starting to get these minor pain-like symptoms. And in the fibromyalgics, we would say, okay, all our traditional therapies, we know that exercise works, that getting people to be more aware of their bodies works, but it's the adherence to it that is where we fall down on in these patients. And so fibromyalgia programs will show that, you know, 6 months post-intensive physio and relaxation, all those sorts of things, all good body awareness stuff, improves their pain. But 1 year on, you've lost that because patients are no longer adhering to it. And perhaps it is that simply we spin them the wrong line somehow. And if we can explain to them that maybe there is this mismatch going on and that their treatment is to try and improve their body awareness and just find a mechanistic cause for it. And obviously in fibromyalgia, there's many other changes that happen as well. You know, I wouldn't like to say this is purely a motor sensory mismatch. That's not the case at all. But I think it's exacerbated by those problems. And I think that's why some days things are very good and some days they're not. They're just on that cusp where they flip back and forth between generating symptoms and not.
Do you think there's a different disease process
wrong
between any or not?
I think you could almost do a spectrum, that I think those people with the chronic regional pain sorts of problems, I think they're much more vulnerable to getting a CRPS-like intervention. So just as you say, and we've got lots of patients where they've gone to have carpal tunnel release when actually there was no real evidence that they ever had a carpal tunnel trap, but they were reporting pins and needles, they go on to get CRPS. And they, clearly when we did our healthy volunteer study, there were about 20% of people who could have done this with a mirror all day and never had a problem at all. So there's got to be some genetic predisposition to these types of conditions. And if we could identify those, then that would be really helpful.
Peter, in the meantime, I'd just like to ask Alison, with your new intrathecal service, in what way, I might have missed, you might have said, but in what way are you assessing outcomes?
Actually, I think I forgot to say. I think as with several things, we haven't quite finalised it yet, but we are, we're pain scoring patients beforehand. We have in fact run one patient already, and so we're using pain scores, but we're also looking at things like, we've got an audit tool which looks at things like opioid consumption, other analgesic consumption, bed stays and admissions for pain relief reasons. Certainly the one patient we ran from last June until about 6 weeks ago had multiple inpatient admissions for cancer pain control prior to the intrathecal device going in, and didn't have any. So it's a lot of it, I suppose, is financial type information, so that we can gain the information with which to say this is a good service, we want to keep it going. Although I know that information already exists, there are papers that show that, but it will help in continuing to prove our case. So it's sort of pain scores, analgesic consumption, quality of life type stuff as well, but we've thought about it and we've put some stuff in place, but we haven't yet finalised it, I think is fair. Guys, yes? Yeah.
Work in progress, I think. I'd also like to ask Ali, and I a question in relation to an issue that came up in our visit when we were down in Truro. And it's to do with psychological distress issues, which clearly are, you know, a major issue in patients with advanced cancer. But it was particularly to do with patients who had an intrathecal put in and then had good pain relief and then went on to become, I think, more distressed because psychological issues were, I think, more to the forefront of their minds because they were no longer sedated by, you know, high doses of opioids, etc.
That's not uncommon in the cancer pain population in general. With any, the pain can be a focus, and even if you're just titrating up according to the WHO criteria and you achieve pain relief, that will often unmask previously unresolved issues. And I guess we consider that part of our role from a palliative medicine perspective is we would just continue to address things like that. We do have access to psychology services, certainly in the Beats, and I'm not entirely sure what the local hospices have got. We do have limited access, but a lot of it we would deal with probably ourselves, but refer on things that are more complex.
Thanks.
Time for two more questions. First one is David at the front.
There's a question for Professor Vlayan. Just here. The video you showed of the in vivo exposure and so on was very intensive and individual based. I was wondering what experience you have of doing this kind of in vivo exposure work in a group based format, because a lot of my experience of doing group based pain management work actually looks a bit more like graded activity than in vivo exposure. Is it possible to individually tailor it enough to do it in a group format?
That's a very good question, and a difficult one to answer, because so far we haven't done it in group, and one of the main reasons is that it's not just exposure what you're doing. What you're actually doing is trying to prevent, it's more like response prevention. You try to prevent the defensive response in confrontation with the feared stimulus. Now the defensive, we didn't have enough time to go into that in more detail, but I talked about the avoidance response, escape, attentional focus, arousal. But another more subtle kind of defensive response is what Sarkowski's named safety behaviors, which is, for example, looking for extra support during the exposure to minimize the catastrophized consequence. For example, when someone has to lift something, he will use the other hand to support a little bit the back. And these can be very, very subtle safety behaviors. Now, if we allow these safety behaviors, initially, in the beginning, it's not a big problem, but if you allow these safety behaviors for a longer time, you will get a limited extinction. Now, because these are so individual, imagine having 5 or 6 patients doing exposure with all these different kinds of subtle safety behaviors where you have to intervene, because each time you see one you have to say, okay, very nicely done, now we're going to do it again, but this time you're not using your right arm to have this extra support, so now we're going to do it without support. And that's practically very difficult to do in a group. Now, having said that, we want to try out a group session where we have a more larger educational part, where we instruct all the participants in the group in looking at each other for this kind of safety behavior. So using the patients as the therapists of their peers in the same group. We haven't done this so far, but I can imagine that it can be done, maybe not with all groups. And then it would be a nice experiment to see what happens. And maybe if patients or participants are trained to see that in other people, maybe they are more alert for themselves as well. Although that's not always the case. But
right. Well, can you put your hands together to thank the speakers?